Chapter 71. He recognised the copy from 4 miles off. Into his memory, its shape was indelibly etched. The symmetrical slope of the sides cobbled with boulders that glinted dully in the sunshine, like the scales of a reptile. The flattened summit ringed by a boulder stratum of rock, the high altar on which the sacrifice to greed and stupidity had been made. Closer, he could discern the aloe plants upon the slopes, fleshy leaves spiked like crowns and jewelled with scarlet blooms. On the plain below the kopje, in the short brown grass, stood a long line of white specks. Sean rode towards them, and as he approached, each speck evolved into a cairn of whitewashed stones, and on each stood a metal cross. Stiff from the long day in the saddle, Sean dismounted slowly. He hobbled the horses, dropped saddle and pack from their backs, and turned them loose to feed. He stood alone and lit a cheroot, suddenly reluctant to approach the line of graves. The silence of the empty land settled gently upon him. A silence not broken, but somehow heightened by the sound of the wind across the plain. The harsh tearing, as his mount cropped at the dry brown grass, seemed sacrilegious in this place, but it roused Sean from his thoughts. He walked towards the double line of graves and stood before one of them. Stamped crudely into the metal of the cross, the words, "Here lies a brave burgher." He moved along the line of crosses, and on each he read those same words. On some of them the printing was irregular. On one the R in burgher had been replaced by a G. Sean stopped and glared at it, hating the man who in his haste and unconcern had made the epitaph an insult. "I'm sorry," he spoke aloud, apologising to the man who lay beneath it. Then he was embarrassed, angry at himself for the weakness. Only a madman speaks aloud to the dead. He strode away towards the second row of crosses. "Leading Seaman W. Carter, R.N., the fat one. Corporal Henderson, C.F.S., twice in his chest and another in the belly." He walked along the line and read their names. Some were just names. Others he saw instantly and vividly. He saw them laughing, or frightened, saw the way they rode, remembered the sound of their voices. This one still owed him a guinea. He remembered the bet. "Keep it," he spoke, and immediately checked himself again. Slowly he went on to the end of the line, his momentum running down as he approached the grave that stood separate from the others, the way he had ordered it. He read the inscription. Then he squatted down comfortably on his haunches beside it, and stayed there until the sun settled and the wind turned cold and plaintive. Only then he went to his saddle and loosened the blanket roll. There was no firewood, and he slept fitfully in the cold of the night and the icier cold of his thoughts. In the morning he went back to Saul's grave. For the first time he noticed that grass was growing up between the stones of the cairn, and that the cross sagged a little to one side. He shrugged off his coat and went down on his knees, working like a gardener over the grave, weeding out the grass with his hunting knife, making certain the roots were removed. Then he went to the head and lifted the rocks away from around the cross. He tore the cross from the ground and re-dug the hole for it, setting it up again carefully, plugging the base with pebbles and earth, and at last packing the whitewashed rocks firmly around it once more. He stood back, brushed earth and flakes of whitewash from his hands, and surveyed his handiwork. It still was not right. There was something missing. He thought about it, frowning heavily until he found the answer. "Flowers," he grunted, and lifted his head towards the aloes on the kopje above him. He set off up the slope, picking his way through the litter of boulders towards the summit. His knife slipped easily through the soft, thick stems, and the juice oozed heavily from the wounds. With an armful, he started back down the slope. Out to one side, a patch of colour caught his eye, a sprinkling of pink and white among the boulders. He detoured towards it. Hottentot daisies, each one a perfect trumpet with a pink throat and a fragile yellow tongue. Delighted with his find, Sean laid aside his burden of aloe blooms and went in amongst them. Stooping like a reaper, he worked through them towards the lip of a narrow ravine, gathering the flowers into posies and binding the stems together with grass. Finally, he reached the ravine and straightened up to rest his aching back. The ravine was narrow. He could have jumped across it with little effort, but it was deep. He peered down into it without much interest. The cleft was floored with rain-washed sand, and his interest quickened as he made out the half-buried bones of a large animal. But what made him climb down into the ravine was not the bones, but the bulky leather object entangled with them. Sliding on his backside the last few feet of the descent, he reached the bottom and examined his find. A leather mule pack, double pouches, and the buckles of the harness almost rusted away. He tugged the whole lot loose from the sand and was surprised at the weight of it. The leather was dry and brittle, faded almost white with exposure, and the locks of the pouches were rusted solid. With his knife he slit the flap of one pouch, and out of it cascaded a stream of sovereigns. They fell into the sand, clinking upon each other in a heap that glittered with merry golden smiles. Sean stared at them in disbelief. He dropped the pack and squatted on his haunches over the pile. Timidly, he picked up one of the discs and examined the portrait of the old president, before lifting the coin to his mouth and biting down upon it. His teeth sank into the soft metal, and he removed it from his mouth. "Well, damn me sideways," he invited. And he laughed out loud. "Ha!" Rocking back on his haunches, and lifting his face to the sky, he roared out his jubilation and his relief. It went on and on until his laughter dried suddenly, and he sobered. Cupping a double handful of the gold, he asked it, "Now where the hell did you come from?" And his answer was in the grim face embossed upon each coin. "Boer gold." "And who do you belong to?" The answer was the same, and he let the coins trickle through his fingers. "Boer gold." "The hell it is," he growled angrily. "Starting this minute, it's Courtney gold." And he began to count it. As his fingers worked, so did his brain. He prepared his case against his own conscience. They owed him the balance outstanding on a train of wagons filled with ivory. They owed him his deposits in the Volksgas Bank. They owed him for a shrapnel wound in the leg and a bullet in the belly. They owed him for 3 years of hardship and danger. And they owed him for a friend. As he stacked the sovereigns into piles of 20, he considered his case, found it good and proven, justified it, and gave judgment in his own favour. "I find for the appellant," he announced, and concentrated his whole attention on the counting. An hour and a half later, he reached the total. There was a huge pile of coins upon the flat rock he had used as a desk. He lit a cheroot, and the smoke he drew into his lungs made him light-headed. His conscience had surrendered unconditionally, and in its place was a sense of well-being, all the more intense for the period of depression through which he had come. "Sean Courtney accepts from the government of the one-time Republic of the Transvaal an amount of £29,200 in full discharge of all debts and claims." He chuckled again and began shoveling the gold back into the leather pouches. With the heavy pack slung over his shoulders and with his arms full of wildflowers, Sean went down the kopje. He saddled his horse and loaded the pack onto his mule before he went to pile the flowers on Saul's grave. They made a brave show of colour against the brown grass. He lingered another hour fussing over his floral arrangements and resisting the temptation to thank Saul, for now he had decided the gold was not a gift from the Republican government, but from Saul Friedman. This made it even easier to accept. At last he mounted and rode away. As the man and his horses dwindled into insignificance on the great brown plain, a dust devil came dancing up from the south. A tall, spinning column of heated air and dust and fragments of dry grass. It weaved and swayed towards the graveyard below the kopje. For a time it seemed as though it would pass wide of it, but suddenly it changed direction and dashed down upon the double row of crosses. It snatched up the flowers on Saul's grave, lifted them, ripped their petals, and scattered them widely across the plain.